What I wanted to do is actually really try to bring this home by talking about the core functions of public health and trying to give you guys some examples of the ways that public health can actually step in and start to help its brothers and sisters in other areas to really do some good work where this problem is concerned. And I have a number of different things in here that are designed to kind of give you a good storyline for this. One thing I want you to think about is that, you know, public health tends to frame things in terms of numbers, and we tend to talk about why things are important in terms of burden load, for example. What I'd like to start off with is more of a personal connection to this, and we may not have time to actually read this whole slide, but what the case that I presented you with, and this is actually a real case, what it presents you with is a situation that unfortunately is not all that atypical. It's one where you have a person that's over the age of 60, and in this particular situation, her abuser is her 46-year-old son. The description here actually gives you a variety of different detailed pieces about what actually happened in the situation, and it also points out some of the risk factors and vulnerabilities that are at play. So, for example, in the blue, one victim-related risk factor that's here is the fact that this particular woman needs oxygen in order to be able to breathe, basically. Puts her in a situation where some care might be needed with respect to that part of her overall health. The other portions of the slide highlight some of those things that are risk factors associated with the perpetrator in the situation. Again, the 46-year-old son is living at home with his mother. Now, I know we're living in a hard economic situation right now, so that might start to shift some of the norms about what's typical, but in most situations, you don't see 46-year-olds living with their parent unless they're actually acting as a caregiver. But in this particular situation, I want to reinforce some of the risk factors that we already talked about today. So one of the risk factors that tends to be associated with the perpetration of abuse is drug addiction. Drug addiction will make people who in average situations might be really good people, really caring people, turn into monsters with respect to how they interact with the people that they care about. I know that because my family has a history of drug addiction, so I've seen it in a variety of different manifestations. And lastly, when we talk about this case of Joanne and Greg, one of the things that we have to focus on is that these abusive situations tend to be long-standing. You know, it's never a case in most situations where you just have some very serious, very acute event happens. Rather, there tends to be a sequence or a chain of interactions that in some respects accumulate to the point where either the person who's being abused actually gets fed up and they report it themselves, or someone else actually witnesses an event that brings it to the attention of the authorities in a given situation. So as I talk about some of the system stuff, remember that we have to take this situation of elder abuse and keep it from being abstract. As I talk about the numbers just a little bit, and as I talk about system-level phenomena, think about this commitment that we all are supposed to have to public health service to stop elder abuse for millions of individuals, or how many ever the number actually is, such as Joanne Cornelius, and even Greg Cornelius as a person who would be a part of the perpetration aspect of this. Okay? So, moving on back into this idea of public health significance, I think there are several things that we're all probably aware of that result from this process of abuse. We know that it's associated with higher rates of illness, injury, distress, and disability. Some of that has already been highlighted. But one thing that I think people don't think about a lot is that there's actually a community-level impact, too. Elders in many communities used to serve as libraries, if you will. I know when I grew up, for example, I could go around the corner and talk to any of the older people in my community and learn about the history of the community or the history of the society as a whole. But elder abuse can potentially impact the community because those people who might serve as resources may not be available because they've been socially isolated. So that's one way to think about how the life of the large community is impacted by the absence of those individuals. We know that there is a health cost associated with this particular situation. When Pam was presenting a few moments ago, she talked about financial abuse and some of the economic impacts that are associated with this. But we got to think about how when you deal with people who have been abused, there are going to be some medical interactions that will contribute to the overall expenses associated with medical care at the societal level. And one last thing that's most important to highlight is that experiencing abuse or neglect has been shown to potentially lead to premature death. So to illustrate that more directly, I want you to take a look at this figure for just a moment. It's from one of the rock stars in the field, Dr. Mark Lax. And what it shows is a survival analysis figure that actually compares the survival trajectories for people who have been exposed to elder abuse or mistreatment, who've been exposed to self-neglect versus the survival trajectories of people who haven't had any exposure, or at least who haven't been investigated in this particular situation. And what easily becomes apparent is that the people who, for all intents and purposes, haven't experienced this tend to live a lot longer than the people who have either been involved in a self-neglect situation or experienced some type of physical or other type of abuse. So I think this brings the point home in terms of the possible impact where longevity is concerned. Now, I want to give you a little bit of a frame in terms of the burden piece, but next I need to quickly hit this particular part of the situation that deals with needs and gaps in this particular field. And I'm going to run through this very quickly so we can talk and explore just a little bit some of the aspects related to our field itself. This is a reproduction of the same figure that Mary showed you guys. I just put a little bit of a color into it, and I found a bigger iceberg to illustrate this. And actually, I'm bringing home the same point that she did, but instead what I did with this particular figure is take two of the many different estimates that are out there with respect to reporting, and I combine them to actually give you a range of values there. So one figure actually says that anywhere from 1 to 5 cases, for every one case, there's about 5 that goes unreported. And there's another one that Mary just talked about that says it can go anywhere from 1 to 23.5. So that actually gives you a range from about 4 to 20% of cases that actually get detected, but a range of 80 to 90% that don't even show up on anybody's radar. So I think that that actually gives you one of the reasons as to why we have some work to do as the members of the Gryffindor house here, because that 80 to 90% should scare you, because that means there may be a lot of people who aren't really being brought to light in a way where their situations can be resolved. And so we don't have information about exactly how many elders have been abused. We can't tell whether the problem is getting worse or better. And one of the things we can't really do with a lot of certainty is actually describe the burden distribution and its variation across populations, areas, and settings. Okay? We do have some numbers out there. There are some good studies. But what you have to remember when we talk about studies and some of the numbers is that they may come from individual efforts. What we're trying to get to is a situation where we have the most accurate and comprehensive assessments where the prevalence and incidence of this particular phenomenon are concerned. And I have one slide that I'm going to quickly show you. You won't probably be able to see it well because of the way that the slide is showing up. But what this slide does is sort of further emphasize what I just said a moment ago in terms of there being a lot of different estimates about the magnitude of this particular problem. So in one respect, you've got different studies that I'm showing here. The Pillemer and Finkelhor study, for example, said approximately 1 million U.S. adults actually experienced abuse. And this was done back during the 1980s. You've got other people who also were interested in trying to actually quantify this a little bit. So, for example, the National Elder Abuse Incident Study, based on APS data and based on, Pam, was this the one that they did Sentinel reports off of?
Yes, correct.
Based on Sentinel reports, reports from people who come into contact with older adults more frequently, they presented a figure that actually talks about, in 1996, there have been about 450,000 people who actually wound up being identified as experiencing some form of physical abuse or neglect. So that's another figure that's floating out there based on one of the sectors that comes into interactions with older adults. As you move across the figure, and we're going to make some of this information from the presentation available, you'll be able to look at it in more detail, you'll see that different people, again, have provided different figures on the problem, some that are fairly consistent with others, and then you see others that depart from each other vastly. So, for example, two of the most recent studies conflict with each other in terms of what they say. Laumann et al., in terms of looking at the past year prevalence, they said that it was about 9% verbal, 0.2% physical, and 3.5% financial mistreatment. Whereas, if you look at Rhonda Sharonow's study, what you see is that he said the one-year prevalence is about 4.6 for emotional abuse, 1.6 for physical abuse, 0.6 for sexual abuse, and then he outlines a number of other figures in terms of the national study that he did. So, my main point about this is that, yeah, we have numbers, but sometimes the numbers can tell you different stories from each other. So there's work to do in the field to reconcile those numbers and figure out how we can get on the same page to have the most accurate image again as to what's happening with this. Okay? So we don't know a lot, and that should become obvious by the way that the presentation is actually unfolding. When we talk about how to deal with this, yeah, there are some things out there that might be effective in terms of prevention or intervention, but effectiveness evaluation, unfortunately, that's not something people do a lot. I mean, people get so tied up in their passion that they want to do stuff, but evaluation, even at this particular point in public health development, particularly where this field is concerned, just hasn't caught on. You know, people sometimes don't have the finances to support somebody that's able to actually do an official evaluation. So that makes this process difficult sometimes. And that's why, for example, we don't know what works definitely. There are some things that we think that have promise in terms of what they might be able to do. They just haven't undergone any form of evaluation. And also, if something does appear to work, what we need to also know is, why does it work? Because one thing that you might figure out, you might know this from your own public health experience, is that what works in one place may not work somewhere else. So you need to be able to figure out what components translate to different situations. What are the core components that might be replicable, that have to be replicated in order for this to work? And what conditions might actually moderate the effectiveness of whatever it is that you're trying to do in the first place. So to make this conversation a little bit more dire, not intentionally, but you know, for the purpose of giving you guys a realistic sense of where we are, when we talk about evaluation, again, it becomes a little bit confusing because there's a lot of evidence that you can use in evaluation. I've presented a figure that has three different forms that everybody should take into account when you're looking at some type of prevention or intervention program. So one challenge that we have that's not only a challenge for elder abuse, it's a challenge in other areas, we have to figure out how do we take the research evidence, the contextual evidence, and the experiential evidence and combine it in a way where we can have effective decision-making possibilities in place. So that's something really to keep in mind, because to be able to have a long-term impact, this is where the field has to go. Now, I'm going to try to hit this very, very quickly so that we do have some chance to talk, and if people have questions, we can open the floor up. As you know, there are three core functions of public health and 10 essential services. I've got a bunch of content on this slide. We're going to make these slides available, so what I'll probably do to modify my approach is maybe choose one of the several different suggestions that I have in terms of public health contributions. Public health brings a lot to the picture. I like the little muscle man right there. Kind of illustrates what it is that we bring to the table. We've got strength in activities such as surveillance, etiologic research, and program development and evaluation. And we also have expertise in public engagement, partnership creation, and supporting practice-informed, evidence-based decision-making. Okay. In terms of moving to the core functions and 10 essential services piece, I hope everybody here is familiar with this. Is there anybody that hasn't seen this before? Good, good. One person? Well, that's good, because I was hoping in our field, I would hope at least some people were familiar with this. I've been in places where people go, what are you talking about? But this framework is one that I think was first developed in the mid-90s, and what it does is give you a good connection as to what we should be doing as public health workers in a public health system. So I'm going to go ahead and hit this really quick. The different services that I'm going to highlight will fall up under those three broader subheadings, assurance, policy, development, and assessment. Okay? So I'm going to make direct connections to each of the 10 essential services very quickly, and if you guys want to follow up and talk about some of the content that I have a little bit later on, we can do that. So we all know that the first essential service that's highlighted there involves monitoring health status at a basic level. In that particular context, public health has strong surveillance skills. We have made our credibility and our claim to fame based on creating good surveillance systems. So one thing that we can do in that regard is help the broader field refine its methodologies and approaches for doing good data collection. That's actually something that at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, we've been working with the Administration on Aging, the National Institutes on Justice, and a variety of other groups to help the field make some advancements in that particular area. Also, beyond just simply helping with the monitoring function, I want you to think about how we have a role to play where the diagnosis and investigation of elder abuse as a potential health problem is concerned. One thing we can do in this particular regard is actually help to support and promote some of the approaches to increasing the effectiveness of risk assessment, case identification, and abuse investigation processes by actually assuring that all of the relevant parties are at the table when those types of discussions happen. And to kind of make this more concrete, when we talk about risk assessment, for example, we heard a little bit earlier that screeners for elder abuse don't either tend to be utilized or they're not in a position where they've been widely evaluated. So as a part of the work that we've done at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, we've collaborated with SAMHSA And we've also worked with the Administration on Aging and a number of experts in the field to talk about some of the things that might be included in a risk assessment. With the Affordable Health Care Act, part of that setup involves a yearly annual visit with older adults. Yeah, we had an opportunity to comment on the possibility of including an instrument in that particular suite of risk assessment tools that are going to be administered in the interactions with older adults. But we were sadly met with a situation where, when we looked at the instruments in the field, none of them actually fully met the expectations and requirements for good assessment. So there's some work to be done in that area, and we can play a role in that particular process. Beyond that particular point, in terms of education and consciousness raising, of course we've got skills in this area. I like the fact that public health is very deep in terms of social marketing. We have a lot of good campaigns that perform health education functions. And as I said a few moments ago, health promotion tends to be something that we really can hang our hat on. There is a very deep need for social marketing campaigns in the broader field of elder abuse. And I think that that's a particular role that we can actually fulfill in terms of collaborating with some of the people that are already starting to work on this. In terms of partnerships, public health by definition is a convener. Public health, if you think about people as being in a room and representing different sections, public health actually represents probably the social butterfly, because by definition, our constitution is one where we do our work because we bring in people from different disciplines. I'm a sociologist by trade, but one of my collaborators in the elder abuse at the CDC is a physician. We work with psychiatrists. We work with psychologists. We work across a lot of boundaries because what we're concerned with is not which particular clique you're associated with, but what skills you can bring to the table to help us work on this public health problem. So our role in this particular situation should be straightforward. We can help with stakeholder engagement and constituency development. And what we can also do is provide technical assistance in order to help sustain relationships that are developed for the purpose of doing good work in multi-sectoral partnerships to address elder abuse. And I think that that's something very important to think about, because in this climate where money is lacking, to be able to do elder abuse well, you have to collaborate. I have to work with AOA, for example, because CDC does not have a budget line to support elder abuse. So some of the work we've been able to do is by virtue of phone calls, lunch meetings, and just direct interactions with people to make sure we can make a go of this situation. And as you might know, there are probably a variety of other things that I could point out in terms of the essential services and functions. But as one final example, so we can have maybe like about 5 minutes or so to get into the discussion piece, I do want to highlight the fact that we have a policy level function in terms of how we work with the topic of elder abuse. So think about what public health is good at, again. And one thing that you might automatically know is that we are all about comprehensiveness in terms of interaction as well as planning. So in one respect, what we tend to do very well in terms of our work is that situation where we try to make sure that whatever strategy you utilize to approach a health problem is going to include everything that you need to be in place for it to be effective. So I think that there's something that we can do in terms of introducing that element of rigor to these processes that are going to be designed to deal with elder abuse as a community health problem. And I also want you to think about how, at a policy level, we tend to have expertise also in terms of collaborating with those groups that have the ability and authority to generate the rules for interaction that specify how we deal with certain situations. So we might have a role to play, for example, in working with Adult Protective Services to help them make their processes for investigation more robust and better structured. And we might also, for example, have a role to play in terms of helping to develop protocols and guidelines that will introduce an element of standardization when it comes to case identification. That's actually another issue that is at the forefront of some of the conversations in the larger field of elder abuse. Okay? Well, thank you for bearing with me as I tried to barrel through some of this stuff. I've got a number of other slides that I'm not going to be able to get to with this, but as I said before, we're going to share some of this materials, and if you have any questions about the remaining pieces that I didn't touch on, please feel free to contact us. Are there any questions or any statements at this point?
I just have a quick sort of global, mm-hmm. There's so much detail, and I'm really new to the field. So given the growing national health crisis, especially in the rapid, not just nationally, but globally, internationally, what is the role of the agency? And who are the cheerleaders and or what advocates, and how does someone move to both the field and the APHA, you know, really get involved?
Okay. Well, that's a couple of different ways.
Oh,
no problem. I can answer that actually with maybe one or two responses. APHA works largely through sections and components, and you're actually in a good situation because I'm a member of one of the components that this work ties into. I am a part of the Injury Control and Emergency Health Services section, and within that section, we have a Violence Prevention Committee. So this topic is one that has a home inside of that particular section. And that committee, for example, through its work, has given us the opportunity to do this particular session today. So it can be through an avenue like that that you can actually have an influence at the organizational level. We also have people such as Mighty Fine, who's the gentleman sitting on the second to the last row back there. He's actually served. Mighty, are you our section counselor? Our section representative. And what he's actually done, he was instrumental in allowing us to do this in the first place. He's also put forward some policy statements that focus on the topic of violence. So that's one particular type of avenue that we have available to begin doing some work related to topics such as these.
Okay. And also the aging and public health section would be another way that you could think about it. And there's a sort of special little group called the ethics group. And a lot of this has to do with ethical treatment. This is human rights issues, really, too. So it could fit in that place as well.
Right. And yes, ma'am?
I think just as a side note, not necessarily just APHA, but this should take a special look from epidemiology as well. I mean, one of the real challenges in the field is really good incidence and prevalence data, and to bring to bear the great resources that APHA has in that kind of study, really looking at the community-based impact would be a very important area to pursue.
Right. Agreed. And, you know, I know I sped past that particular slide, but as I said before, surveillance is an area that we have strength in. And so, for example, at the federal level, one thing that, you know, PAM has been involved with along with a number of other people in the field is an effort to create standardized definitions for elder abuse. You could go from Alabama to Georgia and look at the same person and draw different conclusions because our legally mandated definitions differ. Sometimes it's not just differences by states. It may differ from county to county in one state. So we've got work to do in terms of bringing people together where that element is concerned.
Then the one other sort of conundrum, but you talked about the cost-benefit analysis, so it would be the economist friends of ours who are dealing with this issue. Institute of Medicine did a really nice panel. I was fortunate to be on it, and it was on prevention of violence. Violence prevention ought to be cheaper than having to do violence remediation.
Right.
And yet the literature is pretty well established for the cost benefits for young people and pretty well established for intimate partner violence or domestic violence. When you go to elder abuse, though, we like felt that the iceberg just dropped.
Yeah.
Because the problem was twofold. One, most of the cost benefit analysis is on years of productivity lies. So when we tried to do that, and you take an 85-year-old, well, the measures don't apply because an 85-year-old is probably not going to ever return to the workforce.
And they stop at 65 usually. So
the other issue that was around that was potential health costs. And I know the physician who was by me from Argentina goes, oh, Pam, you got a problem there? We fixed them up. They cost a whole lot of money in the healthcare system, too. And so I realized that we really have a tremendous, you know, the burden of the problem has to be actually have different measures for just cost benefit because it's a different kind of way to calculate.
It is.
And I get, unfortunately, I don't know how you guys go, but when I start talking about quality of life loss, everybody's eyes glaze over and the policymakers run out of the room.
Yeah. Yeah. Mary?
I was just going to make one point, which is, you can tell that to be in elder abuse, you have to have a pretty good sense of humor. I encourage you all to join us because we have a lot of fun, even though it's a really serious topic. And it's something about which, once you're passionate about it, the passion never lets go of it. So, you know, it's a pleasure to have been able to present with the two of you.
Likewise.
And come by our booth. We're going to make them hang out with us, too. We can continue the conversation there. Or if you see me at the bar, I will buy you a drink.
Yeah.
Hey.
Do we have any other thoughts or questions that people would like to put out? Yes, ma'am.
Disparities,
yeah. There's actually a good bit of information out there about variations in the framing of elder abuse and in definitions and responses. For example, one of my good friends, Shinshi Dong, he does a lot of research in the Chinese community. And, he's one of those people that talks about how culture actually dictates what actually is abusive to people, so that me responding verbally, you know, offensively to an elder in Chinese culture might be worse than me actually hitting them, you know, in many situations. We were talking about, before the session started, because Mary asked me to be a part of a webinar series that's focusing exactly on this topic, I'm going to do a presentation that talks about elder abuse in the African-American community. And one of the reasons why sometimes the reports may be low in that part of the demographic spectrum is because spirituality sometimes comes in. And that's a little bit of a broad brush to paint, because spirituality varies now more because people don't have some of these traditional religious affiliations. But sometimes abuse might not be reported because you think of it as a cross to bear in some situations. I've actually been in some situations where we've looked at work where people say, you know, this may not be right, but this is part of my cross, so I'm going to just bear this cross and allow it to play out the way it's supposed to be. You know, it may sound fatalistic, but culture may have some role to play in terms of how people face that stuff. You know, and plus, if we do talk about the connection to increasing the likelihood of it, there are some ethnic groups that just will not, for example, release older adults to nursing homes or assisted care facilities or even in-home care because they do truly believe, hey, this is my family member. I have to take care of this person. You know, so the possibility for, you know, negative interactions can increase if you don't avail yourself to some of the outlets to take, you know, the edge away in some situations. Not saying that stress is the only thing responsible, but the stress with the combination of adequate coping resources or some personal disability could up the likelihood of abuse. So there's a lot of stuff out there, you know, in summary, that ties into the cultural piece of it.
If you want to look at some global issues, look at an article by Elizabeth Podnicks, who sort of done some early work on an international study of elder abuse, and she's working on a second one. You can sort of see a little bit, you get a little bit of information about, you know, just the spectrum of how countries are dealing with that. It would be Journal of Elder Abuse and Neglect. I can't tell you the publication here, but PODNIEKF.
Yep. And if you're interested in the definition part, look up work by, is it Margaret Hudson?
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Margaret Hudson. She's like a pioneer in that side. I'm going to get the one person in the back to come back up. Yes, ma'am. They're going to be available through the APHA thing, but if you want them directly, just, you know, email us. You know, we can give you cards or whatever, and you can get them more directly that way. Yes, ma'am.
I would like to ask you a question about if you came across any research dealing with, like, self-neglect issues and that fine line between my right to make a choice to get out of my house.
There's lots of them. If you were to email me, I'll get you stuff.
Okay.
There's plenty of good people who've done that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if there are no additional questions, we'll be hanging around for just a moment. Thank you guys for coming. We really appreciate you being here. And don't forget to wear your Gryffindor sweaters out into the world. Okay?